Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Sting stories when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if your plumber said that? Yeah, what if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps has to be incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Nielsen is a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said about it. He said, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that's a great hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Just call and ask for it. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there, georgegordon.org. Well, have you heard of The Sting? There was a movie called The Sting. Oftentimes, the FBI will sting criminals. Criminals like judges and prosecutors, police, public officials, city councilmen, mayors. Yeah, they'll set up an operation that looks like a crime. And then when they get the judge or the prosecutor or the mayor or city council or whoever it happens to be that they've set their sights on, they set up an opportunity for this person to break the law. Now, if he doesn't break the law, then okay, everything's fine. But if he breaks the law, then he's right there to arrest him and prosecute him for that crime. Now, the FBI actually has a department or a bureau or a section that just specializes in that. Police departments all over the country will do that when they're trying to find drug dealers or people that are trafficking in stolen merchandise and things like that. And sometimes these sting operations last for years. And they'll finally get a whole group of people involved. They call them rings, theft rings, or they'll have some drug king or drug kingpin or something like that. Sometimes it involves police and graft and corruption. Now, the FBI and the police do a pretty good job of doing that. Now, who watches over the police? Have you ever thought about that? What do you do when you have police in your local area that break the law? And what if the police don't have a sting out looking for the police that are breaking the law? Then what do you do? Well, there is a process or a program in our legal system. It's called the Civil Rights Act of 1868. After the Civil War, there were people in the South that were violating the rights of blacks and probably some others, but mainly blacks. And so the Congress decided that they needed to set up a program or a process whereby these people could be prosecuted and damages could be awarded from public institutions like counties, cities, states, that had a systematic program or process or program whereby they would violate people's rights, called the Civil Rights Act of 1868. Now, it was brought to the fore very, very often in the 1960s when the Civil Rights Movement was in vogue. Selma, Alabama, and a number of other places in the South, lunch counter sit-ins. What you saw were all of the political programs, all of the political people that were involved, the political process. But the real change in the South was instigated by, and probably 90% of it was accomplished by, the Civil Rights Act. When cities and police departments and counties and municipal corporations and things like that, and their insurance carriers have to pay out, you know, thousands or in some cases millions of dollars, you know, it doesn't take long for the insurance company to jump in and say, hey, wait a minute, we're going to cancel your policy, or we're going to double your premiums unless you stop this program or this process. Well, up in Ketchikan, Alaska, there was a case in point. I call it the Fisher Lady of Ketchikan, Alaska. She was a fishing boat captain. She had her own fishing boat, and she'd hire a couple of guys, and they'd go out fishing. And she was a pretty tough lady, kind of like Ronnie Mitchell's mother. You know, if she said Georgie, I just said yes, ma'am. She was kind of that kind of a lady, and kind of a no nonsense type, you know. And one day she was driving her Volkswagen downtown, parked it, and she, for whatever reason, failed to put the proper amount of money into the parking meter. Now, Ketchikan, Alaska is a small town, a little fishing town. They got a big paper mill there, but they primarily just have, I'd say, maybe 2,000 people there. Yet not very many more than that. I think they have one stoplight in town, traffic light. And I don't think they've got more than 30 or 40 parking meters. It's not like San Francisco, you know. But if you don't put your money in the parking meter, they give you a ticket. And they gave this lady a ticket, and she didn't pay the ticket. And one day, she was out about doing her thing, and the police saw her, and they arrested her, and they put her in jail on a charge of, well, you didn't pay your parking ticket, so we're going to lock you up in jail. And so she was pretty incensed about that. She called me down here at the law school, and we talked for a little bit. And I said, why don't you check your state statutes? And I think you're going to find, if it's like most states, that a parking violation is not a jailable offense. And if it's not a jailable offense, and then they jailed you, that's called false arrest and false imprisonment. Now, that doesn't mean that it's worth $1 million like the Rodney King case. You probably remember the story of Rodney King, the black man in Los Angeles, where the police were holding curbstone court, and they beat the guy up, and when the lawsuit was all over, he collected $3 or $4 million, and the city had to change or mend their ways. Now, this isn't a $3 or $4 million case, but when the police, anywhere, breach somebody's rights and lock them up in jail for a day or 2 days or 2 hours, is there any kind of remedy for that? Is there any kind of compensation that's due? And the answer to that is, yes, there is. Now, there's a publication put out by the federal government. It's called Federal Standards for Prisons and Jails. And it sets up federal guidelines that states and municipalities have to follow. For instance, in our state here in Missouri, we have four classes of jails. Class A, Class B, Class C, Class D. They call them 1, 2, 3, 4. My county, Ozark County, is a Class 4 county, so it's got the most lenient standards for jails and prisons. Doesn't mean they have carte blanche, but they don't have to meet the same rigid standards that St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield have to meet. Now, Alaska's only got a few counties, and the towns that are there are fairly small, save for Anchorage and Fairbanks, and this is one of those little small towns. So even though they have the most lenient standards, you still can't arrest somebody for a non-arrestable offense, and you can't put somebody in jail for a non-jailable offense. See how simple that is? Now, I know some of you do-gooders out there will say, well, what are you going to do with somebody that doesn't obey the law and they don't pay their parking tickets? Well, boys and girls, I don't write these rules and regulations. I don't make these laws. I'm just a reporter. And I may not know what you should do, but I do know what you should not do, and you should not arrest her, and you should not jail her. How's that? So even though we might not know what we're going to do with people like that, we do know what we are not going to do. But they did it anyway. Sometimes police do that, and it's called overzealous police practice. The police get zealous, and they go out and they enforce laws, or they do it in a way that's inappropriate. Now, the police are not very likely to arrest another policeman. I mean, you could go down and make this report and say, hey, listen, this cop over here arrested me, and so I want you to discipline him, but that's not very likely to happen. But if you take him into federal court, it's very likely that a federal judge will correct his error. Or a federal court will correct his error. And they did in this case. Now, here's the essentials of it. When she got out of jail, she came down here to the law school, and she went through 3 weeks of school, 2 weeks in courtroom strategy and procedure, and 1 week in the civil rights school. Now, armed with the skills and ability that she now needs to bring a case in court, she went back to Alaska, and she wrote out a complaint, and she filed it with the federal court in Anchorage, Alaska, and she said, hey, these guys down here did this to me, and I want a remedy. Now, once a case has been filed, it winds its way through the judicial process, and it takes a few months to do that. It can take 6 months, sometimes a year. I've had cases that stretched out for a year and a half. But at some point in time, the case has to go to trial, unless it's been dismissed on some technical grounds, and this case was qualified for trial. Now, nobody will settle a case until it's first qualified for trial, and once it was qualified and trial date was set, the insurance company, they're called Northern Adjusters up there, they took a look at this and they said, you know, if this case goes to trial, this lady's probably going to win, and then we're going to have to pay out a lot of money, and we don't want to do that. And so they come to the defendant, or the plaintiff in this case, the plaintiff, and they say, look, how would you like to settle out of court? Now, there's a process for what we call plea bargaining. Well, an out-of-court settlement is the equivalent of a plea bargain. And so she called me and she said, well, they want to settle. And I said, well, there's a book out here that's written by Judge Wenke. And it deals with the art of negotiation. The Art of Negotiation by Judge Wenke. And there are guidelines that you follow to determine what the value of a case is worth. And we went through the guidelines, and this is what we call a nuisance value settlement. And it's worth about $12,000. And so she negotiated, and pretty soon they got down to some numbers, and they got down to where they made some offers. And the case was finally settled for $8,000. She spent a day or two in jail, and I don't think she spent two. I think she spent a few hours in jail. No matter how much time you spend in jail now, during the day, 6 hours, or, you know, 12 hours, it's counted as a day. All right. So she didn't spend two, but she spent part of a day in there. And so now she's going to get paid $8,000 for this day in jail and the humiliation and all the rest of it. Plus, you know, it takes time to file the lawsuit and one thing and another, and it's drug on, you know, for a year and a half. And so it comes down to payday, and they decided that they would settle down at the city hall. So they went down to city hall, and she went in, and she got a check from Northern Adjusters, the insurance carrier, for the $8,000, stuck it in her shirt pocket. Now you have to sign a release. And when you sign a release, it usually reads something like, I agree not to disclose the terms and conditions of the settlement or the amount and one thing and another. And so when it was all said and done, she signed the agreement, and she went out and got in her car, and she drove down the street. She's going back home. And down at the only stoplight in town, you got one traffic light, the two or three policemen down there circled around her with their squad cars, and they stopped her, and they arrested her. And this time they arrested her and they charged her with driving without a license. I guess she didn't have a driver's license. And I suppose in the process of the litigation, they did some research and they looked around. They couldn't find a driver's license for her. And so I think they were kind of mad because they got burned for the $8,000, and they're going to teach this woman a lesson. So here she is again, arrested, and they take her back to jail, and there she is. And so they took her around to the booking department, and they decided they wanted her to take a shower and put on her jail clothes. So the shower there in the booking area doesn't have any doors on it, but it's a partition so that, you know, she could go in behind the partition, and she'd take her shower, and then there's a chair in there. It's a pretty good-sized little area, and shower at one end, and dressing area. And so she's in there, and she went in, and she sat down. Now, she didn't take a shower. And she's in there sitting, and now they don't have a matron there. At that time, they didn't have a matron. Now, remember the book I told you about, Federal Standards for Prisons and Jails? It prescribes that when you're taking care of female prisoners, you have to have a matron. Now, I don't know why we have a double standard, but if you have men prisoners, you can have female guards. And it's all right for female guards to see male prisoners naked, but male guards cannot see naked female prisoners. You have to have a matron. I don't know if there's an action there or not, but in any event, that's the way the game is played, and I don't make the rules here. So anyway, they didn't have a matron, and she's in there, and she's sitting there kind of quietly. And so the guard, the duty officer, he says, hey, Are you dressed? Are you finished? And she says, no, I'm not. And don't come in here either. And so he stayed out, and a little time goes by and by, he came back over, and he said, hey, are you dressed, and are you ready? And she said, no, and don't come in here. And so some time went by, he didn't know quite what to make of this. And so he said, now we're going to come in here, and we're going to, and she said, no, you stay away. And so some time went by, and so two of them said, all right, we're coming in, ready or not. And she said, no, stay away. Now, the two guards, two males, they came around the end of the partition, and there she was sitting in the chair, very quietly. And each one of them got on one side and one on the other and picked her up. And she screamed, and she said, no, don't rape me, don't rape me. And she pulled away, and she crawled around the end of the partition. These guys were so shocked at her aberrant behavior that they let go of her, and she crawled around the end, and her blouse was open, and her bra was off, and there she was with her breasts naked to the waist, crying out to the others in the room, the other officers in the room, don't let them rape me, don't let them rape me. Now, I suppose most people would say, why, that's kind of preposterous. I can't imagine that these two guys would want to be raping this lady. But you see, here's the problem that the police face in a circumstance like that. First of all, two male officers don't have any business in there to start with. You got to have a female. Now, for whatever reason, something happened here. And when they picked this lady up, the buttons on her blouse fell off on the floor. That's the evidence. And the little metal straps on her bra, there's two of them, and they were straightened out. Well, the evidence there would indicate that somebody grabbed her bra, pulled it violently and straightened them out, and it fell off. She jerked away, fell on the floor, screamed, crawled around the end, and that's what everybody saw. So you have the bra for evidence, you have the buttons on the floor for evidence. And you've got a rule here under federal standards that says you got to have a matron, they don't have one, and you got two guards over here that have accosted her. That's an assault. Now, they settled that second one for $12,500 in an out-of-court settlement. Now, the last time I heard, they had not arrested her again. Now, what that tells us, then, is that City Hall is not impervious to the law. It is true that City Hall and police officers do get away with an awful lot, and there's not very many people that would have the presence of mind to cry out, no, don't rape me. And, you know, that's the way life is, and so I just thought that I'd tell you a little story there about the sting. And that's a pretty good sting story, wouldn't you say? All right, so there's another sting story, though, that comes down. And this time it works a little bit differently, and it works for another agenda. It's called the Morton Grove gun control case. Morton Grove gun control case. This was a sting, but it was a kind of a reverse reaction sting. A little town in Illinois called Morton Grove, Illinois, being very public-minded people, the city council and the mayor, decided that they wanted to protect the people from firearms. So they enacted city legislation called a city ordinance banning the citizens of Morton Grove from having, owning, carrying, displaying, or having a gun even in their house. I mean, that's pretty all-encompassing, isn't it? Now, many people looked at that and said, well, listen, little city councils over here cannot impair a Second Amendment protected right in our Constitution. And so it's this kind of action, political action, that causes people to get excited. And so here's this law that's on the books, you know, kind of like it or lump it. Well, fortunately for the good folks of Morton Grove, Illinois, they had a champion. They had a local lawyer in town. He took exception to this law. And he said, you know, I'm going to challenge the constitutionality of this law. I think it's a bad law. I think that it violates our Constitution. Now, you'll notice that the ACLU didn't jump in there, or the NAACP didn't jump in there. You don't find any of these liberal organizations jumping in there to protect your Second Amendment rights. But fortunately, for the good folks of Morton Grove, we had this lawyer. So he brought an action in the local state district court, sued the city, alleging that this law abridged his Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms and blah, blah, blah. And so the case wound its way through the district court. I don't know for how long. Probably not very long, because it was dismissed out. It didn't go to trial, never had any discovery. Didn't bring in any witnesses, didn't do jack diddly squat. The judge just kicked it out and said, no, I'm going to dismiss this action. Obviously, this was a sympathetic, gun-grabbing judge on the side of the city council. And by God, we're going to abridge the citizens' rights whether they like it or not. Now, that's what the gun people thought. So the lawyer now, he's no dummy. He's not going to sit down and take this lying down. So he appealed to the Illinois Court of Appeals. And so the case winds its way into the Illinois Court of Appeals, and it sits there for a while, and some time goes by, and the Illinois Court of Appeals dismissed it out. Without comment, they just threw it out. Can you believe it? I mean, here we are, citizens of this great nation of America, and here's this city comes along, and they clearly violate our Second Amendment rights. And when you go in there and you try to get a redress of grievance, will the courts hear you? No! They just dismiss you out. That just makes your blood boil, doesn't it? Well, by God, this lawyer is not going to be dissuaded. So he appealed to the Illinois State Supreme Court, complaining about the behavior of the courts below and how they erred in not allowing this case to move forward and to bring in witnesses, evidence, and testimony, and discovery, and due process, and equal protection, and rights, and all that good stuff, you know. And so the Illinois Supreme Court, you know, they listened for a while, and they bandied it about, and pretty soon they dismissed it out. Can you believe this? Can you believe that a state of the United States would treat a citizen so poorly? Deny him a day in court? Well, now, there's only one remedy left. You know, when your state Supreme Court dismisses you out, and keeping in mind that the federal question here is the Second Amendment to the federal Constitution, so we've got a clear-cut federal issue. No doubt about that. So we can get into the U.S. Supreme Court, cost $300. You got 90 days to appeal, and so our hero, the lawyer from Morton Grove, filed his appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, it made headlines. I mean, it made headlines coast to coast and border to border, and I was in Boise, Idaho at the time. And one of my students came in one day, and he says, have you been reading about this Morton Grove gun control case? And I said, well, I've read a couple of stories about it, yeah. And he said, what do you think? And then I said, well, what do you mean? What do I think? And he said, well, how do you think the Supreme Court is going to rule on this Second Amendment issue? And I said, well, the Supreme Court isn't going to rule on it. They're not even going to hear it. They're going to dismiss it out, just like the Illinois Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals and the District Court did. And I said, when they dismiss it out, you can rest assured that the newspaper headlines from coast to coast and border to border are going to say, U.S. Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance. And he said, how do you know that? And I said, because this lawyer here is he's an Uncle Tom, and what he's doing over here is he's bringing a propaganda case for the gun grabbers. He's a gun grabber. He's not defending the Second Amendment. He's generating a propaganda blitz here for Morton Grove's gun control ordinance, which is clearly unconstitutional. There isn't anybody that would sit there with a lick of sense and say that that was constitutional. But you see, the courts aren't going to hear it because under Ashwander versus TVA, the courts will not listen to a case in which there is not a vital controversy at issue. And this guy doesn't have any standing because in order to have standing, he would have to be injured by the operation of the statute. And he clearly was not injured by the operation of the statute. He was never arrested or jailed or fined. Nobody took his guns away from him. He didn't have a cause of action. The courts didn't err. Nobody violated his rights. Nobody denied him due process or equal protection of the law. He didn't have any rights to defend. He didn't have any due process or equal protection claims to advance. He never had standing to walk in and talk to anybody to start with. Never had a cause of action. And so the courts, because he didn't have a cause of action, they dismissed it out, which is the proper course of action. It's the way the rules read. It's the way the game's played. I don't know how many people complained to me and said, oh my God, look at these gun-grabbing courts and these dirty, low-down, no-good judges over here working for the Illuminati and the conspiracies and, you know, one thing or another. Conspiracy theorists, you know, are jumping out of the closets here and trying to make a heyday out of it. So, anyway, sure enough, about, a week or two or three later, the Supreme Court dismissed it out, just like I kind of figured they would. And sure enough, the Idaho Statesman had banner headlines, and it said, Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance. Now, the Supreme Court did not uphold their ordinance. They didn't rule on it one way or the other. They dismissed it out and said, we're not even going to hear it. Not going to give you an opinion. Now, as far as I know, the gun control ordinance in Morton Grove is probably there. The correct modality, in case you want to test this case in Morton Grove, is what you do is you strap on heat. Now, not under your armpit. Now, you strap on a gun and you walk down to the chief of police on Main Street and you say, hey, Bob, I'm packing heat. And here it is. What are you going to do about it? Just like Rosa Parks got on the front of the bus. She got on the bus, sat down the front, and said, okay, I'm sitting down the front, and I'm black. What are you going to do about it? And in Rosa Parks' case, they arrested her and put her in jail. Now she's been damaged. She has a cause. I think they prosecuted her and found her guilty and fined her money. Now she's been damaged by the operation of the statute. There's a vital controversy at issue for which she's entitled to a remedy. And she got it. So if you want to test one of these cases, there's a modality for accomplishing that goal. But as a sting operation, this lawyer performed a sting against the gun owners of America, a propaganda sting. And it worked perfectly. Worked like a shot. Hey, it's halfway time. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about stings and sting stories, and there's quite a few interesting stories. A sting is something that occurs when the police, typically it's the police that sting lawbreakers. You'll have an undercover narcotics agent, and he'll go out and buy drugs from some drug pusher, and then when he makes the purchase, then he'll arrest the wrongdoer and he'll take him off to jail, and that's called a sting when you do that. Sometimes they're pretty elaborate. The movie called The Sting, that was a pretty elaborate sting operation. There was one time, there was done by the FBI. There were 5 or 6 representatives and 1 senator, Senator Harrison. If you'll remember from, I think it was New Jersey. Oh, this had been 20, 30 years ago now, but this was called the Abscam Sting that the FBI did. And they caught this senator taking bribes, and he was stuffing money in his pocket and taking bribes. He was pretty corrupt. Now, you've got about 100 of these senators that take bribes, and they're pretty corrupt. But they don't catch them every day. They just catch one once in a while. And it happened that they caught this guy, Senator Harrison. Now, there were 4 or 5 House of Representatives reps that were also caught in this abscam sting. And up in Cook County, Illinois, that's an easy place to catch wrongdoing. That place has got a lot of bribery going on. Anyway, they've caught judges, prosecutors, police, public officials up there breaking the law, and so that's a pretty good thing to know. Now, occasionally, though, citizens do the same thing. At one time, I had a student in here named Fred, and he lived in a little town in New Mexico called Deming, New Mexico. Deming, New Mexico. And they had a law down there in Deming, which was an identification law. Now, there's some court cases that have come out over the years. One called Brown versus Texas, and another one called Lawson versus Colander. And this is back here maybe 20 years ago or so. Well, Deming, New Mexico, had a city ordinance on the books that required that when you get stopped by the police, that you had to identify yourself. Now, Arizona just enacted a law like that, where, you know, the police can stop you if they're suspicious. I guess it's got to be reasonable suspicion. I'm guessing, I don't know what the probable cause standard is, but I'm guessing reasonable suspicion. And then they're going to ask you for your papers. You know, I could just picture this now, you know, walking down the streets of Phoenix, and policeman comes up and says, "Hey, you, identify yourself." And there I would be, standing there on the street, confronting the policeman, and the question arises, well, how should I respond to him? You know, most people don't know. You know, what do I have to do? You know, do I have to produce identification? What if I didn't have any identification? Is there a law in America that says you have to carry identification? Most people do. I don't. I don't have any ID at all. I just walk down the street. People want to know, well, who you are, and I am who I say I am. And so, anyway, Fred, he came down here to school, and he was concerned about this law, and I told him, I said, you know, there's 1,000 issues out there, Fred, and that's a good one, that's a good one. A guy by the name of Brown had that very same issue, and a guy by the name of Lawson, he had that issue, and they both won their cases in the U.S. Supreme Court. And I said, you know, Fred, I think that you could take that issue on in Deming, New Mexico, and I think then you'd have a case in the U.S. Supreme Court that says Froelich versus Deming, New Mexico. You'd be famous. You'd be famous, like Miranda versus Arizona, you know, or Yoder versus Wisconsin, or Silverthorne Lumber Company versus U.S. I mean, you know, all these names of cases that have been decided in the past, you'll be written up in the literature and immortalized. He thought that was a pretty good idea. So there's always this problem of, well, how are you going to get this case before the courts? Now, remember that, I think I covered this last week. I told you a little story here about Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. There's a 7-part test that the Supreme Court has imposed upon all of us in order for you to test a case, to get a case qualified for appellate review. Well, for that matter, in order to get a case qualified for trial, you have to follow these 7 rules. It was done back in 1936, and I didn't write this, so, you know, I don't have any control over it, and I don't know if it's good or bad or right or wrong. I'm just here as a reporter to tell you, well, if you want to get into court and you got a case that you want to argue, you got to follow these 7 rules. And so Fred came down here to school, and so we showed him the 7 rules. And said, this is what you got to do. Now, you have to get arrested. Remember the story of Rosa Parks? Well, you know, this is what we call a goat. The person who's going to get arrested, the person who's going to test this case, has to get arrested. Now, you can bet that Rosa Parks, before she was selected as the goat by the ACLU and the NAACP to be the person who was going to be wronged by this Alabama law, they have to take that person aside and say, now let me explain to you that when the policeman comes over to arrest you, you can't kick him in the shins. You can't spit in his face. Because if you do that, then the policeman can use what's known as the minimum force rule. And boy, that's not going to be much fun. And it'll spoil our case. You see, the goat has to be a victim of police brutality. And if you kick the policeman in the shins, you know, then the policeman arrests you. You know, that's hardly police brutality. He's just doing his job then. So you've got to be the victim. You know, if the policeman pulls out his mace, or he pulls out his gun and shoots you, or his zip gun and electrocute you, or something like that, you know. We have a thing here called overzealous police practice, police brutality. and there's laws against that, you know, in case some of you policemen didn't know that there were laws and rules that regulated your conduct and behavior, there are. Fortunately for all of you policemen, nobody knows what those rules are, so you can run roughshod over just about everybody. But once in a while, you know, doesn't happen very often, but once in a while, the police will run up against somebody like the Ketchikan lady or like a Fred here, who do know what the law is and do know where the lines are drawn in the sand, and then we get into the sting portion of the case. So Fred was faced with the problem of, how do I get the police to arrest me? How do I get the police to even know that I don't have any identification? You know, most of the time when you're walking down the street, the police don't just walk up to you and say, hey, bub, identify yourself. And you can't very well go to the police and say, hey, listen, I would like to test this case, so would you please come out here and arrest me so that I can tell you that I'm not going to identify myself. And so he said, well, you've got to draw some attention. And said, one of the best ways for you to draw attention is to wear a gun on Main Street and just walk down the street. And when a policeman sees you walking down the street packing a gun, now you want to make sure that when you do this that you've looked at your state statutes and find out what the state statutes require, so that everything you do is exactly according to the law. You know what I mean? See, we want to look like we're breaking the law, but we don't want to be breaking the law. Now, Rosa Parks looked like she was breaking the law. There was a law that said blacks have to ride in the back of the bus. She sat down in the front of the bus. Sure looked like a crime to the bus driver. And when the policeman got there, sure looked like a crime to him. But when the case was finally adjudicated and got all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, everybody was just real surprised and found out, no, this lady's not breaking the law at all. My God, the legislature was breaking the law. The governor was breaking the law. And the police were breaking the law, and the bus company and the bus driver. Everybody was breaking the law but Rosa. What? Isn't that surprising? So, Fred goes to Deming, and he straps on his .45, and he starts walking down Main Street, and sure enough, didn't take too long, a policeman driving down the street saw Fred walking down the street, minding his business, just walking down, with a gun on. So the policeman, probably doing his duty, pulled up to the curb, rolled down the window, and yelled out to Fred, on walking down the side of him, he says, hey, come here. And so Fred stopped, and he walked over to the police car. Now, the policeman's still sitting in the car, and behind the wheel, and pretty friendly guy, I suppose, and he's looking over through the window. He's got the window down. And he says to Fred, he said, what's your name? Let me see some ID. And Fred said, am I under arrest? And the policeman said, no. And Fred said, well, I don't want to talk to you. And he just turned on his heel and walked away. Now, the police are very sensitive to that. I mean, I've tested that a couple of times, and I can tell you very plainly that when you just turn on your heel and say, I don't want to talk to you, and walk away from the policeman, he just gets really incensed. He thinks you're being rude, obnoxious. And so this policeman, Fred told me the story, he said the policeman stepped on the gas, peeled rubber, moved his car forward about 30, 50 feet or whatever, slammed on the brakes, opened up his door, jumped out, ran around the front of the car, and got up on the sidewalk, got right in Fred's face and said, I want to see some ID. Now, right away, when I see a policeman like that, I say, now there is a Marine drill sergeant. He's been in the Marines, he's been a drill sergeant, and he's bringing this back from the Marines with him. See, these military people, they don't understand civil rights. They don't understand constitutional due process. They have practiced the Uniform code of military justice. They don't understand rights. They don't understand due process. They don't understand Brown v. Texas or Lawson versus Colander. They never heard of such a thing. And that's the stuff of what we call constitutional confrontation. So Fred said, "Am I under arrest?" And the cop said, "Yes, you're under arrest." "Oh, okay, I'll go quietly." So the policeman put the handcuffs on him, disarmed him, and searched him. And Fred didn't have any identification on him. He didn't have a wallet. He didn't have anything in his pockets. So here's the policeman. He's standing here on the corner. He's got this, you know, on the sidewalk. He's got this guy arrested. Caught him in handcuffs. Doesn't know who he is. Doesn't know where he came from. Didn't know where he was going. The guy's just walking down the street. Now, here's a good little side light that you probably ought to keep in mind. You need to have proof. Remember this Rodney King? There was a guy taking video tape of this. It's always good, and in Boise, Idaho, when we were operating Barristers Inn, we had a guy up there named Ted, and Ted had a Dodge van, and he had a video camera. Ted used to be a cameraman with KIVI, the public television station, and he had the van rigged up with a video camera, and he had a microphone on the outside of it. And Ted told me one day, he said, "That microphone is so sensitive that it will pick up a hummingbird's burp at 100 feet. And so we would put that van out on the road, and then if we could catch a policeman out there arresting somebody, and then maybe the policeman would get excited and grab this person and throw him on the ground, kick him in the ribs three times and slap on the cuffs, you know, things like that. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for criminal behavior on the part of the police. Now, we very seldom ever see that. And most policemen don't do that. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying, you know, that all the police out here, you know, are a bunch of animals. That's not true. But they've got some animals in the ranks. And those are the guys that we're after. See, it's kind of like judges and prosecutors. They're not all bribe takers, but there's a few in the ranks that take bribes and break the law. And those are the judges that the FBI is after. Those are the public officials that are taking bribes and perverting justice that the FBI is out to get. So don't think that all the judges and all of the public officials now are bad guys. They're not. I've never run across a bad judge. I've run across a couple of dumb ones, but I never run across a bad one. Not yet. All right, so now Fred is loaded into the car, and he's hauled down to the police department, and they're trying to figure out who he is and where he came from, what he's doing and why, and one thing and another, and he won't tell him. He doesn't tell him anything. Now, Heibel hasn't been decided yet. Now, the Heibel case is kind of a hybrid case. There could be that you need to tell him your name. My name is I.P. Daly or Harry Wolf or whatever you want, whatever your name is. That could come into play, but at this juncture of time, Fred would be the Heibel of his day had this case ever gone forward in the event that it did. But you see, it didn't. And so after a while, they released him. But, you know, the damage has been done when you arrest somebody. And then I told Fred, I said, "That's a mistake on your part. You should stay in jail as long as possible." But see, they set bail on him for $100, and Fred paid the $100 and bailed out. Oh, that's a mistake. Never bail out. You want to stay in jail as long as you possibly can. And that's right. You want to stay in. Because, see, every day that you stay in jail is further damage. And the courts have said that it's not reasonable to believe that the police will only arrest the guilty. And they have a rule called the shock the conscience test. You need a case that so shocks the conscience that it demands a remedy. And getting arrested on the street and hauled down to jail where you post $100 bail and walk out is hardly shock the conscience. You know what I mean? So that being the case, I wasn't shocked. And now he settled in an out-of-court settlement. And this was another one of those out-of-court, what they call nuisance value settlements, and it settled for about $8,000. And I thought, well, $8,000. Now, here was the kicker, though. Fred said, I want this law taken off the books. And the adjuster who is trying to negotiate the settlement said, I don't have any power to make the city council take it off the books. And Fred said, well, if you don't take this law off the books here in Deming, New Mexico, I'm going to take this case to trial. Now, boys and girls, it costs about $12,000 to do a three-day trial in federal court, $12,000. And the insurance company has to come in and defend. Now, Fred has a ticket now to the U.S. Supreme Court because it's a Second Amendment federal issue. That's very helpful. To get into the U.S. Supreme Court now under Ashwander, we have to have a federal question. And in this kind of a case, we've got a federal question, and it costs about $250,000 for an insurance company to take a case to the Supreme Court. And the question arises, does this insurance company really care about the Brown v. Texas and loss and identification rule? I can tell you from personal experience that the insurance companies really don't care about that. They just care about making money, collecting premiums, and not paying out any claims. So the insurance company went to the mayor, and they said, now, Mr. Mayor, we need this law removed from the books. It's unconstitutional. The mayor said, no, it isn't. It's a good law, and we're going to keep it. And the insurance company said, well, you know, this law is going to cost us a lot of money. We're going to have to go argue this, and we think we might lose. And even if we win, we really don't care because we don't care what this law is. We just don't want to pay the money. So what we're going to do is double your premiums or cancel your policy. And I had a federal judge explain that. It was Judge Callison. One time he said, Mr. Gordon, you're not going to find any sympathy over here with the public officials or with the insurance companies because they don't care a rat's you know what for your rights. What they care about is the money. And they care about their insurance premiums being doubled or their policy canceled. And they care about the deductible. So that's where it's at. And sure enough, they met an executive session, and they decided that they would remove the law from the books in Deming, New Mexico, so that you good folks down there can walk down the streets now packing heat without being arrested and jailed. Isn't that special? Doesn't help you in Albuquerque. Doesn't do anything for you in Boston or New York or Chicago or someplace else. But in Deming, New Mexico, one of my students named Fred set up a sting, stung the public officials, got the law removed, collected $8,000. Now, next time I'll tell you about a couple of stories where the police do this. False arrest, false imprisonment is pretty much what we're looking for. And when they break the law like that, you know, you're entitled to get paid. These are not cases where you're entitled to $1 million or $5 million so that you can retire for the rest of your life. You're just entitled to be paid for the day or two or the week that you spent in jail, falsely arrested, and got a black eye on your record. Hey, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that we are the Law Hour, and you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and